As I elaborate in the book, I'm afraid of appearing a little defensive here, in a very careful way to say there is no physical contact or romantic engagement. The reason why I chose the lover as the analogy is in the real world outside of psychoanalytic practice, where else do you have an interpersonal encounter that is so intensely engaging, attentive, respectful, caring? And that would be in the first 6 weeks or 6 months of a romantic relationship. So if we eliminate the romantic sexual part and just stay with, wow, this other party is paying such attention to me, reminds me of Lacan's idea that what we really seek in the other is their desire for us, which, by the way, I don't completely agree with because I think it goes both ways. But I would say that that is the analogy from the world of lovers that I would map onto psychoanalytic work, at least on the part of the psychoanalyst, that he or she ideally pays that kind of intense attention, care, respect, attunement that you would find between lovers.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Alan Karbelnig. Dr. Karbelnig is a psychoanalyst, a writer, a teacher, and a forensic psychologist, and practices in Pasadena, California. He has written a book entitled Lover, Exorcist, Critic, Understanding Depth Psychotherapy. And we discuss these three character traits that he feels usefully describes the analytic encounter, lover, exorcist, critic. And in the book, he demonstrates these points by presenting composite clinical vignettes. And one of them is the focus of our conversation, because he describes with remarkable honesty and transparency a treatment that went awry, an analytic frame that wasn't any longer working in the best interest of the patient. Our conversation begins also with a vignette that's in the book from many years before in his training analysis that also seemingly to me represents a frame that went awry. And we sort of conjecture how those two events, though separated by many years, may be related. The details of his treatment and the factors that remedied it I will leave to our conversation for you to hear. Suffice it to say, it is an unusual self-revelation to us about his vulnerabilities. And I learned a great deal, and hopefully listeners will as well. He is a supervising and training analyst at the New Center for Psychoanalysis in Los Angeles. He lectures nationally and internationally. He writes a weekly Substack newsletter titled Journeys to the Unconscious Mind. In addition to this book, he's published 20 scholarly articles and 5 book chapters. And a point of pride for him is his founding of a clinic entitled Rose City Center, which is a nonprofit clinic providing dynamic psychotherapy for those who could otherwise not pay in private fees and would not otherwise see the inside of an analyst office. And we discuss the details of that, and it's, as I say, it's a point of pride for him. I hope you find this as meaningful and unusual a conversation as I did. Here is my conversation with Dr. Alan Karbelnig. Alan, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you here.
Thank you.
Alan, our field is paying increasing attention to the psychoanalytic frame. And there are many reasons for this, but one of the reasons is certainly that we are seeing more patients come to our office whose character structures are organized around narcissistic and dissociative defenses. And as a result, we need to shape our frame in order to better engage these particular patients' avenues of emotional accessibility. Now, some people, when they refer to the frame, they think of it in literal terms, that is, the couch and frequency, and others think of the frame in mentalized terms as the analyst state of analytic thinking and experiencing and the sharing and co-creating that with each individual dyad. But however one approaches the frame, there is a category where most would agree that at times the frame goes awry. And by awry, I mean that it has stopped serving the needs of the patient to deepen their awareness of themselves and their experience. And you've written a book entitled Lover, Exorcist, Critic, Understanding Depth Psychotherapy. And there are many parts of this book, and we're gonna get to many of it, including many of the theoretical thoughts you have. But you include in it three composite cases. And one of them, that you call Gilda, you describe with remarkable transparency a frame that went awry, that at a certain point in the treatment, you were involved in a way that was no longer serving the patient's interest. And you describe that, and you describe the remedy for it, the repair of it. And I want to immediately say that this did not involve any sexual boundary crossing or any physical boundary crossing. It was not of that sort. And we'll get to what sort it was. But before we do that, I want to share with you, and I have mentioned this to you before, something else that jumped out at me when I read your book. And that was you describe what to me is another frame problem that you tell me is about 15 years prior to your even meeting Gilda. And that took place in your accounting of an exchange, an event that took place with you and your training analyst. And to me, I will read the paragraph you wrote about it, seemingly as the book unfolds, sets the stage for your boundary issue. And these are your reflections, and you write about your training analyst. I quickly learned how, despite his interpersonal coldness, he at least listened carefully. He remembered nearly everything I said. In this manner, he showed a degree of devotion to me, even caring. However, the emotionality ended there. On one occasion, well before the internet, I asked him if I could borrow an issue of The New Yorker from his waiting room. I prefaced the request with an acknowledgement that if he kept past issues in a binder, took them home to his wife, or otherwise held on to them, I would withdraw my request. He failed to respond to my question. Instead, he interpreted my behavior asking, quote, Do you think your request could reflect a sense of entitlement? No, I replied. Had I expected to be given the issue, stolen it, or not asked him in a considerate manner, then perhaps I had been entitled. But I did none of those things. At the end of that month, when I handed him a monthly payment for services he rendered, I wrote a check for $5 short of the total. A few days earlier, I went to the bank in my building where I had the $5 converted into a roll of nickels. I handed him the check with the coin roll and quipped, "This is so you never forget the impact of depriving me of the New Yorker issue." The psychoanalyst said nothing in response to that behavior, even though I was overtly hostile. I was really taken aback by this encounter, and we could spend our whole time together unwrapping the meanings of your wanting to take the magazine, the meanings to you and to him of the way he responded and how you responded, and how your bitterness and revenge was, as you characterize it, was about the impact of his depriving you of the New Yorker, not his depriving you of a response to your question. But what's so striking to me about this exchange is that it was never talked about between the two of you, as you recall it, that the various and multiple meanings, so vital for you, clearly, were never taken up in the analytic work, which is what signals it to me. I don't know if you comment on that or whether we should just jump into the book.
Oh, no, I'd like to comment on that.
Sure, sure.
I was appreciative, Harvey, of you finding that story, which I had not even remembered was in the book, because it was written over a 10-year period. And frankly, I had never really reflected on the fact that even in the weeks following that enactment, the psychoanalyst never brought it up with me. And I must tell you, I feel a certain kind of pride and embarrassment at the same time. Mm-hmm. At the enactment, the pride would be that I went to the trouble of getting these nickels and making this serious statement that was an enactment. The shame is kind of my immaturity at not being able to express my feelings in a more direct way. It was very early in my training analysis, but I think you made a wonderful point, because it never would have occurred to me that that could have been a bit of a preamble to the way I fell off of frame maintenance almost 30 years later.
Okay. Now, let me read a paragraph. And again, there are many paragraphs I could have chosen from the book that introduce your overview of your thinking about this work we do. This is the one I've chosen. And you wrote, quote, "When persons feel chronically insecure or inadequate, find themselves trapped in unsatisfying jobs or relationships, or habitually engage in self-defeating habits, they live in a state of self-deception, of internal oppression. Psychoanalysis exposes these dark recesses of human subjectivity. Further, it introduces people to the indoctrination, the lies, and the distortions affecting our perceptions of ourselves, of others, and of the world. Breaking through our internal conversations proves difficult, whether we learned them in childhood or had them imposed on us by contemporary culture. Depth psychotherapy offers arguably the only professional service directly intended to reverse self-deception and indoctrination. By enlightening subjectivity, by raising consciousness, depth psychotherapy liberates. Its mission is freedom." That's a powerful statement. Do you want to elaborate it for us?
Yes, I certainly would. I'll begin with what over the last few years has become somewhat of a standard way I introduce psychoanalytic psychotherapy to new patients. And that is by saying that, well, we will really be working on two goals here together. We will be striving to reduce whatever the suffering is, and then I would elaborate marital problems, chronic depression, whatever it might be. And the second goal is to uncover as much as we can of your authentic self in the interest of increasing your sense of autonomy. So, yes, I do think that is one of the unique characteristics of the psychoanalytic approach. It helps people find their true selves in the Winnicottian sense, to feel safe about accessing in and expressing those selves. So that would be my elaboration.
Okay. Now, you've come up with these three ways of representing the analyst's presence in the relationship, and you call it, engagingly and provocatively, lover, exorcist, critic. And I'm going to ask you to speak to them, but the first question that jumps out, at least to me, is what made you choose that order?
You know, you wondered if anybody had asked me that question, and in fact, no one has asked me that question.
Oh, is that right? Okay. All right. Well, I hope that doesn't put you on the spot too much.
I think, I know that it is the order in which I address them in the book. That was part of the reason. I think also it kind of rolls off the tongue a little easier than exorcist, lover, critic, or critic, lover, exorcist, etc. And third and last, I would say the terms are deliberately provocative. Critic, not so much. The other two, for sure. And I lead off with the lover because I think one of the things that unites psychoanalysts from Jungians to Kleinians to intersubjectivists is the way they at least should be paying extremely intense attention to their patients. And so I really wanted to highlight that. And I put a lot of caveats around lover for obvious reasons.
Sure. And we'll get into that for sure. But it seems to me that your premise, and maybe this is all of our premises of our work, is that that's what engages patients. I mean, I didn't plan on going back to that quote you had from your TA, but you make it very clear that despite his interpersonal coldness, he at least listened carefully. And that way, he showed you, right, a degree of devotion to me, even caring. And that is essential. Now, yes. not to suggest that the way an analyst cares is the way the patient receives the caring, because there's a whole world of elaboration that needs to take place between those two. But some sense of being that patients are important to us in some way, I think, is a vital beginning of any treatment. And we go from there.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And since I have a longstanding political and scholarly interest in unifying the various theoretical schools that often are arguing with one another, to me, it's a pretty clear unification across models that you pay very close attention to what patients say, the way they behave, whether they're on time or late, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, it's a key unifying foundational part of any kind of depth psychotherapy.
Does that represent your way of thinking about what you mean by lover as one of the three pillars of the work?
Yes, and as I elaborate in the book, I'm afraid of appearing a little defensive here, in a very careful way to say there is no physical contact or romantic engagement. The reason why I chose the lover as the analogy is in the real world outside of psychoanalytic practice, where else do you have an interpersonal encounter that is so intensely engaging, attentive, respectful, caring? And that would be in the first 6 weeks or 6 months of a romantic relationship. So if we eliminate the romantic sexual part and just stay with, wow, this other party is paying such attention to me. Reminds me of Lacan's idea that what we really seek in the other is their desire for us, which, by the way, I don't completely agree with because I think it goes both ways. But I would say that that is the analogy from the world of lovers that I would map onto psychoanalytic work, at least on the part of the psychoanalyst, that he or she ideally pays that kind of intense attention, care, respect, attunement that you would find between lovers.
Got it. That's a very nice description. Now, exorcist. Again, a very juicy term. Tell us more about it and what made you choose that term.
I was and continue to be a big fan of Fairbairn's work. And mm-hmm. he actually used the term in a citation that I have in the book. The brief part of it is the psychoanalyst then is the true successor to the exorcist. So I borrowed the idea from him and then elaborated upon it. Interestingly, when people outside of our field ask me about the exorcist, I need to spend a lot more time explaining it to them than I would to your audience, Harvey, because it mostly applies to character disordered patients. It does apply to all patients in a lesser extent, mm-hmm. and I provide examples in the book. But a recent example, actually fictionalized, well, at least anonymized, right. was a really disturbed physician in trouble with the medical board, really had severe narcissistic personality disorder, and he would go through waves of idealization and devaluation of me that were very dramatic. I'm not going to go into the idealization because those were spectacular, but the devaluations were remarkable in that he would stand at the doorway more than once, exiting my office, and say, Alan, you are completely incompetent. You have no idea how poorly skilled you are. My advice to you when I leave here today is that you contact a senior colleague of yours to get help. Now, I'm answering your question, Harvey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you.
I would ingest that rage, that extreme hurtful devaluation of me. The first couple times it really got under my skin. After that, it didn't really bother me at all. Mm-hmm. But the role of the exorcist was for me to take possession of what was really a highly devalued part of himself projected onto me, mm-hmm. and to use Bion's terms, to digest it and wait until the time was right to reintroduce that to him. And I would say the exorcist function is one of the most stressful parts of being a depth psychotherapist because it requires a lot of tolerance for pain, patience, inhibition of the desire to shout back at someone like right. that. Sure. And that in sum is what the exorcist function is.
And to be clear, none of us do that perfectly.
Of us do that perfectly.
And it's probably not even an aspiration to do it perfectly, because if we don't let patients get under our skin and react to it to some degree, we're not fully present. Obviously, that's not suggesting that we embrace our reactions, but that we are kind to ourselves when we do react and that we use them for self-study and we fold it back into the awareness it offers us for the patient. But yes, absolutely. That is a challenge of the work.
Yeah, I completely agree. And during the idealization phases, for example, he literally said, "Do you understand you are the best psychologist in the state of California, maybe beyond the state?" And oh, those felt very good to receive those projections. Yes.
Critic. What do you mean by critic?
So that occurred to me many years ago in terms of literary criticism, which I know very little about. But I do know that they would, for example, if you were writing a novel and you were to hire an editor to critique your work, they would comment on the arc of the story, where the tension arises, and mapping that onto psychoanalytic work, I would say it's rather commonsensical, and this is the easiest of the three to explain to a lay person, because that is simply, for example, gee, Joe, we've been meeting twice a week now for a year, and I've noticed there's been three relationships with women you've become involved with, each of which ended within a month or 6 weeks, and each of which involved them behaving in a very cold way toward you. I wonder what that might mean. So, unquote, that would be an example, right, of a critique of a patient's life. Some may call it a confrontation. That to me was not a confrontation. But to answer your question more succinctly, it is just like a group of students might critique a novel, a character in a novel. We are on one level offering a caring, gentle critique of a patient's life.
Now, the difference you just described between exorcist and critic is that the exorcist is within the transference, and the critic is observing extra transference behavior or attitudes. Is that an accurate representation?
Yes, it is accurate. And I would say in the middle of the exorcist process, you are possessed and really not in a position to offer the critique. And a few minutes ago when I said, well, you wait, you ingest it and you wait until the timing is right, I would say that's when the critic is engaged.
And that's an important distinction, because often whatever you offer in the throes of the state of being exercised, if you will, is more determined. I spoke to somebody who said it's sort of like the guilt is a hot potato. And it's like when we feel guilt, if that's what's being put on us, we want to get rid of it. So we want to give it back to the patient. And tempting as that is, it's not terribly useful.
Yes. Although, like you said, we all are prone to hopefully a small level enactments, but never are they zero. Yes.
Right. Sure. I want to draw our attention to Gilda, but before doing that, I do want to mention that in the book is a 30-page history of psychoanalysis, and I've read more than a few of those, and I found that to be a really wonderfully succinct and yet rich survey of our field that is worth the price of the book. I just want to put that out there as we get to the challenging part. Now, to introduce it, there was an event in the treatment where your patient that you've named Gilda was assaulted, and you refer to that in this paragraph. But just to introduce this problematic relationship, I want to read the following. Quote, consider the metaphor of the tightrope walker as an analogy for balancing personal caring and psychoanalytic interventions. In brief, psychodynamic psychotherapists walk along a tight wire, balancing their real emotional involvement with patients with their devotion to professionally facilitating transformation. In the period immediately following Gilda's assault, I fell from the high wire. And when our crisis period passed, I readjusted the professional relationship. This painful example of the transference and countertransference with Gilda uncomfortably demonstrates the holism, the layered parts within the wholes of any psychoanalytic relationship. In my work with her, so many levels interacted, including initially my attraction to her, her innocent trust in me, and later that fragile fault line erupting into a full-fledged earthquake when she regressed and I became over-involved. We both enacted features of our traumatic histories. My crossing boundaries through over-involvement and excessive self-disclosure added another layer to the already impasto-like depth of our involvement with one another. Tell us about the first phase of your work with her, including your initial countertransference, and also in the book, you are again very open in describing your vulnerabilities, your illness, the marital difficulties you were going through.
I shall, and first I want to, for any listeners that might be writers themselves, by the time you're done with the book, you just can't even stand it, and you don't want to read a single word of it, and I was pleased with the writing that you just read, Harvey, and almost feels like it's not me. I don't know who wrote that, but it was me. So, boy, how do I make this brief? In 2008, after 3 or 4 months of increasingly severe back pain, it was discovered that I had bacterial endocarditis, which is an infection of the heart, and it's extremely serious. I went, my last appointment with the infectious disease doctor before the diagnosis, I anticipated being referred for a corticosteroid injection in my lower back. That was the worst case scenario. And instead, she told me of the diagnosis and the need for immediate hospitalization. 20 days in the hospital, open heart surgery, aortic valve replacement, all went well, but it's a very traumatic experience, as you can imagine. My common line is I recommend against it. I began working with Gilda, and all the patients in the book are fictional amalgamations of my work with different patients. Mm-hmm. I would say within 6 months of my returning to work, I missed about 8 weeks of work after the surgery. Vulnerable in many ways. I felt physically fine. My marital relationship was a little rocky for details that aren't relevant, and everything's great now. What else? I felt under financial stress. It was the only year that both my daughters were in college at the same time. It was a very difficult period. But despite those vulnerabilities, I think around the first 2 years with Gilda were just fine. She was referred to me by another psychoanalyst who was retiring. We worked through a lot of issues related to the loss of him, the metaphorical loss of him, began to get into some of her highly traumatic early childhood experiences, and really, I would say, little difficulty with the frame. As I say more in the book, I felt very physically attracted to Gilda, tall, statuesque, beautiful woman, more intelligent than me, highly intelligent, and knowledgeable in subjects that I envied, literature, history, philosophy, areas I'm not that well versed in. But managing the countertransference, I didn't think was much of a difficulty. Until approximately 2 years in, she was assaulted at an office party, I go into the details of that in the book. And I think I've now answered your question, Harvey, because that's when she became so severely symptomatic that it was a perfect storm of her difficulties and my countertransference crashing into one another.
Mm-hmm. Now, you do note in the book that she had two instances, at least that she recalled, of sexual abuse.
Yes.
Did that alert you when you started working that that in some way that was going to make its presence known between the two of you?
It did. I would not have anticipated what happened during my countertransference enactments. After she developed post-traumatic stress disorder. Uh-huh. But certainly I thought about that. And her childhood was really highly, highly traumatic, in addition to the two sexual assaults, one of which really bordered on an attempted rape. Well, it was an attempted rape. There was envy by her father toward her, competitive envy, cold rejecting mother. She really stands out as one of the more severely traumatized patients I've ever worked with. And that was prior to the assault.
Right. Now, you say her post-assault PTSD, but to be clear, she really had difficulty. That is that she had fugue states that had her wandering the street dissociated, yes. Exposing her to potential great danger. And she was also a single mother at the time. So this is a special circumstance where one can make the case that one has to do things that are not within a usual frame because the person's life is in danger. So the challenge that anybody would face with whatever vulnerabilities we all may bring are considerable, which is how do we engage with this person who is unknowingly endangering herself and her child? And that's where, I guess in retrospect, it would be fair to say the choices you made, you regretted making. And tell me if this is a fair characterization. They didn't really represent, obviously, what you wished you had done for both of your sake. But why don't you tell us a bit about what it was like for the two of you after she became so disabled?
And I appreciate your kindness, Harvey, because I have quite a bit of shame and embarrassment about some of my behaviors, but in the way you just introduced the situation, it allows some self-forgiveness in that, as you pointed out, some of my behaviors actually were psychoanalytically appropriate or psychotherapeutically appropriate.
Sure.
I had never had a patient with these type of fugue states where she would, in addition to panic attacks, severe intrusive recollections, nightmares, all of the classical symptoms,
right.
She would, with her 16-year-old daughter alone at home, 15 or 16 in that range, leave the house at 9 p.m., the daughter might be in her bedroom. I'm just making this up now. And would not remember anything until 10 a.m. the next morning when she would maybe be sitting on a bus bench in Reseda, California, which is not a very safe part of the San Fernando Valley. I was frightened. So as I mentioned in the book, we were working four times a week. I increased it to six times a week, which I've also never done before. So I went into the office on Saturdays and would meet with her. I got in touch with her psychopharmacologist to make sure we were on the same page.
Sure.
Let's see, what are some other actions I took? I certainly did not seek any consultation at that point. As you know, because you read the book, Harvey, I did later. I think I contacted, there was litigation involving this assault at her work. I contacted her attorney. I think I contacted the orthopedic surgeon. Some of these, in retrospect, I think were unnecessary. Some of them were necessary, like the psychopharmacologist.
Of course.
I don't have any embarrassment or regret about that. And where the unbalance started to occur, I would say within a few months of the assault, she and I became engaged in a dance of my feeling of powerlessness and impotence to help her, combined with the severity of her distress, which began worsening, created this interpersonal, intersubjective enactment that involved me falling off the high wire. And just a quick footnote before I let you speak again. Luckily, because one of the most frightening things to me were those fugue states, which I started to worry about child abuse reporting, et cetera. The adjustment in the medication made those go away within a couple of months. And that was a great relief.
Sure. An important lesson when faced with that kind of difficulty.
Yeah.
Someone listening to this might be scratching their head saying, so what was the problem? What was the frame rupture that was so problematic that has led to all this reflection? How would you answer it? Because so far, I mean, yes, you spoke to more people in her life, maybe, than might be useful for her, but it sounds like, you know, going back to the exorcist that is receiving the projections, you're sort of saying that the helplessness that was awakened in you was intolerable. And rather than processing it, like you described earlier, you enacted it to try to make it go away. And that's what got you, the two of you, off the path. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
Yes. And I'm developing a transference toward you right this moment, Harvey, with you as a consultant and me as consultee. A few details I haven't mentioned were that she had a good income when she started seeing me. That then transitioned into her being on disability, which made it very difficult for her to survive financially. So on several, kind of in a staircase-like way, I lowered my fee. And I know that I started to have some resentment. I think it was unconscious initially at working at really more like a community clinic kind of a fee, also on a 6-day-a-week basis. She developed a seizure disorder, probably related to, well, the injury to her cervical spine and months and months of distress. The neurologist had great difficulty pinning down a diagnosis for.
It sounds like pseudo seizures, psychogenic seizures.
Yes. Yeah. They may well have been. Yeah. She couldn't afford medication. Again, the dance was, I really wanted to rescue her.
Right.
And I think in retrospect, she also displayed less agency than perhaps she had. So one key part of the enactment was my desire to rescue her relinquishing a very smart, capable woman, at least some residuals of agency that were probably there. And as you know, from having read the book, you may want to tease out other details in this. But when I would say that I reached sort of the trough, the bottom of the cycle of this enactment, was when I literally lent her $400 in cash. Well, I didn't lend it to her. I gave it to her. And in that session, when I handed the money over to her, that's when things began to change for me. Because I, even in the very moment, as I think about it now, I was imagining, this is like a drug deal transaction where I'm counting out bills to my patient so she can get this anti-seizure medication. And then I began to regain my footing at that point.
Let's focus on that. I have, because the repair is obviously vital, and there was a repair, and there was a satisfactory ending for both of you, which is no small accomplishment, I would add. Can you start us off by reading, again, your recounting of the repair process? That's the first one on page 128.
As I began to restore the psychoanalytic relationship, Gilda remained engaged with me. She was furious I terminated an element of our relationship that had been beneficial to her, whereas she previously had difficulty accessing the anger she felt at how she was abused as a child, at the other men who exploited her, at her assailants, and at the research institute which abandoned her. Her hostility towards me emerged with fiery intensity. Many sessions consisted of her simply shouting at me, delineating the many ways I failed her. She raged at me for, quote unquote, giving in to her seductiveness. She accused me of lacking empathy for her situation, impoverished, alone, and disabled. Despite her withering accusations, I remained steadfast in repairing the frame. In fact, I held to it with renewed vigor, despite Gilda's intense reactions. I refrained from overtly reacting. I responded with empathy to her intense emotional states, but without any additional self-disclosures. I helped her to clarify her feelings. As she became calmer, I interpreted the rescue victim dynamic, explaining the deeper sadomasochistic contractual level and its tendency to reverse. In fact, the reversal was most evident during this period of her anger at me. I became the weak, incompetent, injured party, and Gilda the triumphant abuser of me. I initially fell into the narcissistic role by entertaining omnipotent beliefs I could rescue her, and when Gilda later transitioned into these intense angry feelings at me, our roles reversed. I took full responsibility for my behaviors. I admitted my errors in ways I had helped her inappropriately and given her the $400. I fully and unconditionally apologized for what was, quote unquote, purely my error.
I can imagine how this whole thing was so difficult for both of you. Not in any way minimizing the greater responsibility on you. It's also the case that patients who have been abused, whether growing up or in treatments or in relationships with others in their lives, the hardest thing to get to is not just their rage at being abused, but how they have internalized that and in some way become an abuser.
Yes.
And it is claiming that last part of their particular humanity that is so vital for the work. And where your, again, your characterization as exorcist, where we sit with the projections, is so vital for their well-being. Of course, it raises the question now of, well, how is this a commentary on your characterization of analyst as lover? Because clearly this is a type of lover, but it's not the type that you mean to be recommending or characterizing in our work. And yet what you feel, importantly, was so vital is that you were able to maintain that lover status, properly metaphorized now, and in enabling her to own herself. And let me ask you to read how you characterize that. That's on page 150.
I will do that, but I just want to make a couple of comments on what you just said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In a sense, the way I fell off the high wire was to become excessively lover-like, as you noted. And the way that I came back from it was to return to normal lover attentiveness and bear her fury at me. And a wonderful irony here and helpful for my self-forgiveness is it might have taken my enactment to get her to access, as you said, the abuser in her, because generally that had been highly repressed and she was much more the masochist in her character structure. But man, oh man, did her rage come out at me during that reparative period. And now I will read.
Before you do that, let me ask you, was there, in addition to her rage at you, was there a link to the rage at the earlier actual abusers in her childhood?
Yes, but not immediately. She became demonically possessed by her rage at me. Right. I don't know if it was weeks or days. And then when the storm calmed, as I mentioned in the book, you always wait to strike when the iron is cold. I was able to explain those to her, and bless her heart, she was very receptive during those calmer moments. And yes, then we could really talk about and work through how she was angry at me, but also represented anger at these figures earlier in her life.
Yeah, yeah, a powerful moment. Why don't you start us off in the middle of that page?
Happily. Yet another irony, my properly resuming the role of lover proved a crucial part in my returning our relationship back to its proper bounds. I contained her rage as I returned to behaving in a normal, professional manner. I listened carefully, avoiding defensive reactions. I empathized, limited my self-disclosures, and stopped talking to collateral parties. I metaphorically gritted my teeth while experiencing those difficult emotions for me, helplessness, powerlessness, as well as an overwhelming feeling of empathy for her post-traumatic pain. My ability, amplified by meetings with a more senior colleague who provided me with some degree of objectivity, to remain in the lover role during this transition period proved crucial. Had I reacted to her fury with my own anger, or had I withdrawn excessively like her mother had, Gilda would never have made her way back to a middle zone of relating with me. The role of lover, even though admittedly I enacted it too literally during the middle period, may well have been most crucial in helping Gilda recover from not only the childhood wounds we had opened up in our work together, but also to recover from the injuries I myself inflicted upon her.
If the listener is intrigued and enticed to learn more about this, I recommend the book. But I do want to leave a few moments for you to talk about something that's very important to you, and that is you are one of the founders of a clinic called Rose City Center that is designed to provide intensive psychotherapy for people who would otherwise never get it. The way I think of it is that you're having people access what psychotherapy can offer them, people who would otherwise never see the inside of an analyst's office. And that's, I mean, this podcast does many things, but it's designed to bring that to the public's attention as well. So tell us a little bit about Rose City Center. I know we're shifting gears, but I know this is very important to you. And you have been most generous and gracious in being vulnerable to our listeners. And I am very appreciative of that. But let's include this thing that you're very proud of.
So continuing on that theme of exposing my vulnerability, I remember clearly, in the late 1990s, I was waiting with my wife and two daughters to take a plane back from New Orleans, where we had had a rather expensive vacation. And I felt guilt at... I was now making a decent living for the first time. And what about the single mom with three children that fell into a depression that could maybe afford $30 a session? Mm-hmm. I had no one in the Pasadena to whom to refer such a patient. I could get group psychotherapy for such patients. I could refer them for psychotropic medication. There was basically no place in Los Angeles County, save maybe an institution called the Wright Institute, that offered such services. So I believe I'm good at organizing things. So I got a group of colleagues together. It was a multi-year process. And in 2004, We opened Rose City Center, which is a clinic designed to, it provides postdoctoral, later we expanded it to include master's level psychotherapists. What they get is hours they need toward licensure. What we provide is a two-year psychoanalytic psychotherapy training. It's obviously not a formal psychoanalytic institute, but we provide the training program. They get post-licensure hours. They actually also get paid a kind of an intern level salary, not much, but more than minimum wage. And boy, in the year 2022, we provided 6,500 hours of psychoanalytic psychotherapy to economically disadvantaged patients. And frankly, as I look back over my more than 40-year career, that is my proudest accomplishment. I serve on the board. I teach a class there once a week. Yes, that is Rose City Center.
And it does have a website, and I recommend it. Alan, you mentioned in passing before that you were having a transference to me as consultant. Well, if you're being that honest, I will as well, that I'm having my own reaction to you. And it started when I read the book. I had powerful reactions when reading the book, and they included at times anger. I was angry at you. I hadn't met you yet. When you described some of what happened between you and the patient. And my thought was, oh, come on. Come on, you could do better than that. The patient deserves better than that. And then when I pieced together what I saw as an early frame breach with you and your analyst, I said, oh, well, okay. So there's a person here. Let me understand this. And my anger has evolved, and this is the second time you and I are meeting. The first was to prepare for this. And my anger is evolving to appreciation and admiration. Again, both for your honesty, because I have never read a case report that shows errors like this. And you are not the only person who makes errors like this, to be clear. And even the use of the word error, I think it's a valid use because it did harm the patient for a while. And most people who make those errors do not come around, do not seek consultation, and do not repair the frame as you did. And you described the ending, and it was, by anybody's measure, as you describe it, a satisfactory ending. And so my anger and frustration and annoyance has grown to appreciation. And I think what you've offered the field, especially in conjunction with your honesty and openness now in our conversation, I think is really very valuable. And I guess I would recommend someone read the book and listen to our conversation to get the most out of it that they can. But I want to thank you for it. It has been a real pleasure for me to learn of you and your work.
I'm very glad to hear all of that. And when you shared your anger, I felt myself transitioning into the exorcist position, but very briefly. And now I just appreciate your admiration. I do want to offer a little defensiveness about the anger. The degree of her distress, it might be the most in the history of my entire practice. Mm-hmm. And then you sprinkle in other things like my attraction to her, my admiration for her. I used the phrase earlier, I want to use it again, perfect storm. But on the other hand, I don't blame you for your anger, because until you hear the whole story, there'd be no reason for you to transform into more of an admiring stance, which I greatly appreciate. And there was one other point I was going to make that's now lost. But I'll say, this is one of the most difficult aspects of our work. In my view, you have to bring your body-mind into the work. We are like actors who say they use their bodies as instruments. We use our bodies as instruments. And it requires tremendous tolerance for pain, self-control, particularly in situations. And I just remembered the other point I was going to make. There were a couple of instances, Harvey, right after the $400 episode, mm-hmm. where I really thought she was just going to quit. And I think it came very close to a horrible ending. She could have quit, filed some kind of complaint against me, who knows? It would have been bad for her, and it might have been harmful to me. So yeah, for the record, there were some very earthquakey moments there. I would say in the 3 or 4 months after I hit the bottom of the enactment, and then it got smoother from that point till the termination.
And if we haven't emphasized it sufficiently, we should, the value of bringing in another set of eyes, of having a consultant with whom we can share our thoughts and will address our blind spots. That's something for all of us to keep in mind always.
Yes, that woman was of great help to me in just sort of stabilizing my emotional state, if you will. And we should all be humble enough to know when we need help. Reminds me of Fairbairn's idea of, I like his developmental model, which is very simple: infantile dependence, transition, and then mature dependence. Mm. Mature dependence means you know when you need to call your accountant, you know when you need to call a senior colleague for help, etc.
Well said. Alan, thanks so much again.
Harvey, thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate the interview.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.